reminded that almost 40 years ago, the first book review I ever wrote while I was a student at Georgetown in one of our publications was a review of Bennett Patterson's Forgotten Ninth Amendment, which I wrote for Faith and Freedom, long ago gone publication on our side. Our next speaker is Roger Kolan, who has been a faculty member at Emory University Law School, a fellow at Hoover Institution and at the Institute of Humane Studies, has served in the Office of Personnel Management in the State Department and the Justice Department, and currently is the Director of Constitutional Studies at the Cato Institute.
Thank you, Leonard. It's a pleasure to be here again. I was here in 1981 speaking before the National Meeting of the Philadelphia Society on very much the same topic. That meeting was dedicated to the philosophy of law. I'm pleased to report, for those of you who haven't followed the history of that thesis, at that time there were a few of us, Bernie Segan, myself, and Richard Epstein, very, very few of us, that's about it, I think, arguing not the thesis that Chuck would have you believe that I'm about to argue, but a thesis that wends its way between that caricature he has posed for you and the position he would have you believe he subscribes to. That article appeared in the Interfaith Studies Institute, sort of laid the foundation for the jurisprudence that later was put forth by Richard Epstein in his Takings book, Stephen Macedo in his book, New Right versus the Constitution, all of which led a year ago, just about this time, to Senator Joseph Biden in his opening round of the first round of the Clarence Thomas hearings, the real hearings, the holding up Macedo's book and Epstein's book, and saying there's a whole school of thought out there that up until 5 years ago it was only speaking to each other, but now is being taken seriously. I'm proud to be part of that school. And it's that school that I'm going to sketch for you ever so briefly today, and to suggest that with Chuck, I too am an originalist. It's just that he's got his originalism all wrong. And there is the difference between the Borkian, you will hear later from Lino Graglia, who has spoken eloquently and humorously on this theme before many audiences, that separates that side from the Brennans on the other side, from whom I want to dissociate myself at least as much as from the Borkians in their approach to the Constitution. I want to give you something of a flavor of how you wend your way between these two camps. Chuck has given you something of a constitutional etymology on activism restraint. I will be more brief. I think the pair of terms is utterly useless, though it has been the terms that's dominated conservative debate. It characterizes only a small domain of constitutional jurisprudence. Let us remember, and I'll develop this point a little later in a few minutes, let us remember that the person who is a judicial restraint advocate, as Chuck would urge, is also a governmental power activist. And those are the two sides of the coin. When you are restraining and protecting rights, you are also ipso facto active in protecting government power. And that coin, that alternative applies equally to the liberal side, which wants to find rights that are nowhere to be found in the Constitution, and in doing so will denigrate powers that are to be found in the Constitution. So that should give you at least an inkling of where I'm going to go in this thesis. I'm going to wrap up with a critique of our good friend and the spokesman for conservative jurisprudence, Nino Scalia, who has gotten it very wrong on a number of points, and I hope to give you some indication of why I think he has done so. But let me lay a proper foundation, as a lawyer would put it, by going back to the beginning that we were told this morning not to go back to, namely the Declaration of Independence. It's my view that we must read the Declaration of Independence, the Constitution, the Bill of Rights, and the Civil War amendments as a whole. That is the only way to develop a philosophy of the Constitution. The Civil War Amendments, of course, made right the terrible wrong that was incorporated as the compromise in the Constitution, and indeed then applied to the states. The place to begin, however, to get a feel for the philosophy of the Constitution is with the Declaration, not least because you see there clearly the division between the moral vision and the political legal vision. And that you find less clear in the Constitution itself, but it's important to focus upon that. The moral vision is itself stated, first of all, from the premise of we hold these truths to be self-evident, which is the most important premise in the Declaration, because it clearly places us in the natural law tradition, the higher law tradition, the tradition that says that there is a law of right and wrong that stands above any positive law, against which to criticize positive law and from which to derive positive law. It is not that positive law is all there is. There are moral standards of right and wrong. And those are defined by rights to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, the Declaration goes on to say. Thus far, it has set forth only the barest sketch of the moral vision, and indeed the vision of general relationships between common law strangers, all of which is defined, as Locke and others of the founders made clear, in terms of property, as we heard this morning from Lawrence Smith and others, lives, liberties, and states, by which I mean property. That's from Locke. That was run through the period of the founding, this idea that general relationships and the rights and obligations that describe them are all reducible to property, and the violations of those rights are reducible to takings of that property, as Fred McChesney made clear in his remarks this morning. Within that framework, however, people can create all kinds of special relationships, which they do through voluntary contracts or through the commission of torts and crimes. And with that, you have the whole world of the common law. The common law that Edward Corwin reminds us was thought to be rooted in right reason and therefore rooted in the higher law from at least the 14th century onward. You have this body of law recognized, indeed, in the various sections of the Constitution, from the Takings Clause, which recognizes property, from the Contracts Clause in the body of the Constitution, from the prohibition of violations of life, liberty, and property without due process of law, from the Privileges and Immunities Clauses, both of the Constitution and of the 14th Amendment, which Blackstone reminds us refers to our natural liberties. You find the Seventh Amendment's reference to and by invocation of the common law. You find the First Amendment, the Second Amendment. All of these are stating variations upon these rights to plan and live your own life, the right to be free from interference of others, whether it be private parties or the government. All of this is clearly recognized in part after part of the Constitution and the 14th Amendment. Now, to secure this world of rights and correlative obligations, governments are instituted among men, deriving their just powers from the consent of the government. In other words, if power is to be authority, if it is to be legitimate, it must be rooted in some form of consent. There, of course, the founders faced the classic problems of overcoming the objection from the anarchist: by what right does one man have power over another? No one has ever adequately answered that question. The arguments here are well known. Majoritarianism doesn't answer the question because, by definition, the minority has not consented. The social contract theory applies only for those people who were in the original position. It hardly applies to subsequent generations. The tacit consent, you stayed there for your vow, won't work either. It's viciously circular because it has the majority putting the minority to a choice between two of its entitlements, its right to stay where it is, and its right to not to come under the will of the majority. No one has ever overcome the problems posed, the questions posed by the anarchists from the state of nature, from the original position. And indeed, the founders implicitly recognized this when they thought of government as a necessary evil, necessary to overcome the problems of self-enforcement in the state of nature, evil in the sense that government was, at its core, a forced association to be guarded against at every turn. Accordingly, the practical problem the founders faced was to create a government that was at once powerful enough to secure our rights, yet not so powerful as to violate our rights in the process of doing so. And toward that end, they created a division of powers between the federal and the state governments, leaving most powers to the state governments. They created the separation of power between the three branches and the checks and balances between those three branches. They created protections. They created, of course, the franchise, which was one protection, but then it guarded us against that franchise through the indirect election of senators, the president, the lifetime appointment of judges. They created a judicial review to oversee the actions of the political branches to make sure they were proceeding from power granted in the Constitution and consistent with rights protected by the Constitution. Most of all, however, and this is the last point that I just made, their whole approach to the Constitution was one of strictly enumerated powers to be restrained by both enumerated and unenumerated rights. That was the whole theory of the Constitution. And it worked fairly well for about 150 years, although the inroads were being made all this time. In particular, in the climate of ideas, you see the demise setting in early on when David Hume in 1739 reminded us that from descriptive propositions you cannot derive normative conclusions. This is an insight which was not really fastened upon until later in the century when Kant noticed it, was a beginning of the inroads on the natural law theory of the founders. Bentham's discussion that talk of rights is nonsense, talk of natural indescribable rights, a phrase which Chuck could subscribe to easily. From Bentham, the father of British utilitarianism, we had these early attacks upon natural rights theory and attempts to place it with utilitarianism. Over the course of the 19th century, also we had the rise of science, not the science of the founders from the Age of Reason and the Enlightenment, but rather a science that was both, there was reductions, both theory reduction and material reductions, and sought to give us a theory by which you could solve social problems through attention to either the nature or the nurture side of the human condition. You had the rise of democracy and the spread of democracy tied in with utilitarianism. All of this reached ahead in the progressive era when we started reconceiving our conception of government. No longer did we think of it as a necessary evil. We started thinking of it as an instrument for doing good, for solving social problems. In 1900, we read The Nation, before it became the nation that it is today, in an article that laments the decline of liberalism, and we find a statement by the editors to the effect that the Declaration has grown today to be embarrassment, whose clauses have to be argued away. This was by 1900, to give you an idea of how radically the climate of ideas had changed. Nevertheless, for the most part, this did not reach into the institutions of government. And there's an important lesson to be learned about looking at that history of those institutions. In 1796, a bill was introduced in Congress for relief of flood sufferers in Savannah. Madison, who knew a little bit about the Constitution, said, "I can find no such power to expend money on this purpose." Giles, a member from Virginia, said, "It is not our duty to engage in beneficent acts, but to exercise our duty to uphold the Constitution." In other words, you often didn't have, through the course of the 19th century, these kinds of measures even getting out of Congress. It is quaint almost to recollect that during the 19th century, they actually debated in Congress about the meaning of the Constitution and about whether they had the power to do some of the things that some of their members wanted to be done. You can imagine Congress today asking, "Do we have the authority under the Constitution to do this, that, or the other thing?" You had, when that mechanism failed, you had presidents actually vetoing legislation all through the 19th century. You have Cleveland saying that it is the duty of the people to support the government, but not the duty of the government to support the people. What president would say that kind of thing today and hope to get reelected? Nevertheless, through most of the 19th century, you really didn't have these kinds of constitutional crises brought to the court, because they never get out of the Congress, or if they did, the executive would often veto them. Nevertheless, you did have cases from the states arising. We talked about Slaughterhouse this morning, which was one of the great inroads on the Privileges and Immunity Clause, from which it is never revived. You had then the so-called Lochner era, the period late in the 19th century, up until the New Deal, in which the court did stand athwart certain efforts on the states to run roughshod over economic liberties. That jurisprudence, however, was never well-grounded, never deeply argued, and indeed it gave way during the New Deal. It gave way because as we all know, of Roosevelt's court packing scheme. When he wasn't getting his way, there was a message that Roosevelt sent to the House Ways and Means Committee in 1935, which said, "I hope that you will not let any constitutional reservations about this legislation, however well-grounded, to prevent you from passing it." That was Roosevelt's attitude toward the Constitution. When he did not get his way, he threatened to pack the court with 6 additional members. The court packing scheme failed on the surface, but it succeeded when the court got the message, stepped aside, and for all intents and purposes, the constitutional game was over at that point. Nowhere more so than in the famous or infamous Caroline Products case, which was a case of unbridled special interest legislation, the filled milk case, in which one part of the milk industry sought legislation to protect itself from competition from another part of the milk industry. That was passed. The court looked at it with credulously as though it was democracy in action. And it approved the Caroline Products, or approved the statute. In famous footnote 4, it distinguished 2 kinds of rights, fundamental from non-fundamental rights, and 2 levels of review. Strict review with respect to fundamental rights, minimal review, which is tantamount to no review, with respect to non-fundamental rights. That has been our jurisprudence ever since. It is all but unscrutable to the average American, because he looks to the Constitution and he sees the grand protections that are there in the Constitution, and he wonders why these aren't being protected. Well, it's because that jurisprudence, which is nothing more than a kind of judicial restraint to allow the floodgate of legislation to be open, has dominated our jurisprudence ever since, and both conservatives and liberals subscribe to that jurisprudence. The only place they part company is in that narrow area that came from the Warren and Berger courts, relating to such issues as abortion, school prayer, and a few other issues such as that. By and large, they are all judicial restraint people. And we see this even on the part of people like Scalia. The recent case of Lucas, which was discussed this morning, is a good case in point, where he tries to build upon 70-odd years of errant jurisprudence in the takings area, which Justice Stevens called open-ended and standardless, correctly so, although he has contributed to it. Scalia takes the position he does because, and he says this, and he said it in a debate at the Cato Institute with Richard Epstein, he thinks the New Deal court decided correctly. So much on substance. Well, setting aside the judicial responsibility to the Constitution, Epstein said in response, and correctly so, that he errs on the side of the political branches, where the risks of failure to enforce the two abide by the Constitution are at least as great, and indeed history bears that out, as is the risk of the court will err in its interpretation of the Constitution. But Scalia goes deeper. He says that a guarantee may appear in the words of the Constitution, but when the society ceases to possess an abiding belief in it, it has no living effect. Well, what in the world do we have a judiciary for if that is the case? Scalia goes on, he says he sees no national commitment to many of the economic liberties that are there in the Constitution. And then he says that what we need to create is a constitutional ethos of economic liberty. Well, we don't really need an activist court to protect the economic liberties that are there in the Constitution. We simply need a court that will exercise its responsibility to the Constitution that it takes an oath to uphold. They don't have to search far in that Constitution to find those economic liberties. Indeed, to hoist Scalia on his own petard, it was he who was on the side of the majority in the flag-burning case, U.S. v. Eichmann, which was hardly a popular opinion. How could he justify the courts standing against that very popular statute in that case? Then again, he goes on in that debate with Epstein to say that where there is this lack of belief in the protections of the Constitution cites, the courts have a hard time. Yes, they have a hard time, especially when they've been there for 50 years in precedent. Nevertheless, the court has a responsibility to do this. At the same time, the court does not operate within an intellectual vacuum. And we come back then to Henry Manning's points from last night. It is the duty of all of us to raise these constitutional issues not simply in the forum of the court, but in the broader forum, in the legislature, in the executive branch, and in popular forums such as this, to make clear that the Constitution does have a vision. It must be read holistically. It was designed to protect individual liberty and to protect us against the encroachment from even the majority whose power cannot be justified from the theory of consent. And that theory of the Constitution is precisely what we have lost because the political branches have failed to live by it, and regrettably, over the last 50 years, the court has failed to exercise its responsibility to protect the liberties that are there in the Constitution for all to see. Thank you.